All right, and you are listening to WRFG 89.3 Atlanta. Welcome to Alternative Perspectives, Atlanta's only local radio hour devoted exclusively to issues affecting Atlanta's queer community. I'm your host, Greg Bossen. Thank you very much for listening. And if you do listen to me, you know that I have been gone for the last 2 weeks on a trip to France and England. It was most interesting, and I learned a lot about art history, and I learned a lot about how nice people in London are and how not so nice people in France are. I mean, I still loved France, and I did love the people, but they just aren't like overly friendly and talkative like they are in London. I mean, it was just interesting. But anyway, I hope I didn't offend anybody there, but the important thing that you need to know is that the opinions expressed here are those of myself and my guests, and they do not necessarily represent the views of WRFG, its employees, board, volunteers, funders, or listeners. So I am excited to be back, and Sharon has been keeping up the show for the last 2 weeks, and I thank her very, very much. Anyway, so tonight's show, and I kind of struggled with this a little bit. I always like to kind of come up with a theme title for the show or a sentence to kind of describe what we're going to be talking about. The main point of this show is really our guest, who I think is quite amazing. Her name is Dr. Annalise Singh. She's a PhD, and I'll talk more about her in a second, but tonight's show, I've decided to call it The Intersection of Racism and Transphobia and How We Heal from Both. So Dr. Singh seems to be okay with that. So now, if you're like me, you may see both racism and transphobia as two different issues, although both have caused much pain and damage to millions of people, including those that are white and straight. But still, I see them as two different issues, racism and transphobia. Well, we have a guest here tonight, again, Dr. Annalise Singh, who has spoken and written at length about both issues, as well as how transphobia is actually one of the many harmful byproducts coming out of institutional racism, and you can trace it all the way back to racism's earliest colonial times, in colonial times. Dr. Singh is an award-winning social justice scholar, an author, a speaker, and a community organizer, and is also a professor and an associate dean at the University of Georgia. Dr. Singh has a lot to teach us, and I am excited to learn from her. And let's make sure people can hear you before I...
Hello.
All right. Oh, actually, you sound okay. Move the microphone a little bit closer to you because Everything that you say is vitally important to me.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Okay, cool. All right. I think I'm hearing you through there.
It's good to be with everyone.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. All right. So, and we are going to be talking about a number of things with Dr. Singh, and including a couple of the books that she's written on racism and on overcoming, transphobia, internal transphobia. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But before we do anything else, as you know, I like to do this.
News of the queer.
I know that's right.
Oh, no, she didn't say what?
No, it's ridiculous.
I love it. I'm into it. I'm here for it.
Okay, cool. I appreciate that. That's good. I still think it's kind of lame, but that's okay. It was my first attempt. So what I do here, and should I call you Annalise?
Annalise is great.
Okay, cool.
I love it.
Okay, I'll try not to call you Annalise, but Annalise.
You know, I'll take any of it.
All right. Thank you. Cool. So we start locally with some news items, and then we're going to move up from there. So this will take about 10, 15 minutes, so I would love for you to respond if you feel so inclined. So first order of business, an influential Republican lawmaker in the Georgia House wants to modernize the state of Georgia's HIV laws, which activists have criticized as outdated and stigmatize people living with HIV. So, and this lawmaker, her name is Sharon Cooper. She's a Republican from Marietta, but she is co-sponsoring a bill to change the HIV law. So currently in Georgia, It is a crime for people living with HIV to have sex or donate blood without disclosing their status, which sounds reasonable, but understand what we're talking about here. The law means that you would need to disclose your HIV status regardless of whether you have safe or unsafe sex at all. The felony is punishable by up to 10 years in prison, and state law also criminalizes spitting it or using bodily fluids on a law enforcement officer by a person living with HIV, an offense that can carry up to 20 years in prison. Now, you cannot get HIV by having somebody spit at you. So, but yet, so I'm not saying that it's cool to spit on cops. I'm just saying that if you're going to make it illegal to spit on a cop, you should make it illegal for everybody. But by making it illegal just for somebody who's HIV, it makes it sound like they're a walking disease, and anybody who comes in contact with them, you know, is going to get the disease also. Presently, Georgia is one of 36 states that criminalize a lack of HIV disclosure, whether or not the act exposed the sex partner to HIV. So activists and lawmakers have been trying for years to modernize the state law to decriminalize the non-disclosure of disease to sex partners. So but this bill, I should tell you what the bill is. So she actually introduced this bill at the end of 2019's legislative session, which was in April of last year. I think they only meet for 60 days or something ridiculous like that. But anyway, but it's going to be taken up in this session, which is why it's important now. So she also is the chair of the Health and Human Services Committee in the Georgia House. And is the co-sponsor of the bill that would revise the state law so it's only illegal to intentionally transmit HIV during sex. The legislation would also downgrade the punishment from a felony to a misdemeanor, which is punishable by a year in prison. The revisions to the law would also decriminalize spitting at and using bodily fluids on a law enforcement officer by a person living with HIV. So we'll see what happens there. But it sounds promising. I mean, I'll be honest, when I first read it, I was like, wait a second, it should be totally illegal. Well, it should be illegal to intentionally infect somebody, but to just say you must disclose your HIV status when you're not actually engaging in any sort of unsafe sex, you know, to me, that's a problem. So, it's been a problem for a number of years. So we'll see what happens with that. Mostly, I'm just shocked that it's a Republican. Do you know anything about this woman?
You know, I don't, but I mean, I
act like you do and say something.
Let me take a stab at it. I mean, I just think that a lot of these anti-HIV laws and legislation just have their roots in racism and anti-queer and anti-trans sentiment. I mean, when we look at the people who are, you know, affected most by HIV, you know, we know who those communities are. And so I just think the continued lack of ignorance, the lack of education, which breeds ignorance, fear, and just misinformation is just uncalled for in 2020 as we head into the new decade. So,
I mean, there's plenty of diseases out there that can be transmitted, and you don't see laws making it a criminal offense not to run around telling everybody about it.
Right. But we also know the origins of just misinformation about HIV from way back in the 80s. And I have strong feelings on this. All my student and young youth activism started in HIV and AIDS.
Oh, really?
Activism in New Orleans, yeah, in the 80s when people were more dying of AIDS than living with HIV. So, yeah, we can do so much better than what we're doing today.
Totally. Totally. I agree. So moving on, because we don't want to spend too much time. See, I can tell me and you are going to be able to talk forever. So this is in Atlanta also. Senator Marty Harbin filed a bill on Wednesday that would allow adoption and foster care agencies in Georgia to refuse to place children with LGBTQ couples. Senate Bill 368 would allow the denial of service when the proposed placement would violate the child placing agency's written religious or moral convictions or policies. People should be very concerned about the introduction of the bill, according to Jeff Graham, the executive director of Georgia Equality. I certainly could not be more disappointed that Senator Marty Harbin is choosing to put a political agenda over the welfare of some of the most vulnerable children that we have here in Georgia. And that population is estimated at 12,000 kids that we have in the foster care system. So basically, the language of the bill doesn't really do anything to protect people's rights to practice their religion as they see fit. But what it does do is it narrows the pool of adoptive and foster care parents.
And goes against all of the research. We know that queer and trans parents are actually some of the best parents they are, whether it's for foster children or other children. It's just, you know, we know the research. We know that children thrive in queer and trans homes. And we know that actually children have a worse go in cisgender and straight homes. When you look at rates of abuse, you look at rates of academic success. So there's so many things that are challenging about this bill. But, you know, and obviously, you know, coming under the guise of religious liberty as opposed to civil rights and humanity.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I had a show last year sometime late in the year with a gay couple that adopted, and what they went through in order to be able to adopt, all of the visitation ahead of time and all of the forms and talking to references and observation in the home. And I mean, of course they're going to be good. They were vetted, basically, in a way that, you know, if you just have sex and have a baby, you know, you're not really vetted. I'm not advocating that we should do that for everyone, but I'm just saying, I think that's one of the reasons why, as you said, gay parents, trans parents tend to be better. That's a horrible thing to say. I'm going to get pushback on it, but I think it may be true.
That's okay. You can look at the research.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So anyway, enough of that. So if you haven't heard about this, you really need to. And I'm hoping that I can play this clip for you. Let me see if I've got it in here. I'm going to have to pull it up here. So this happened last week on Monday in Iowa. During the wonderful Democratic caucuses in Iowa, where a caucus goer tried to rescind her support for presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg when she discovered that the former mayor of South Bend is gay, according to a video clip on Tuesday. The woman was originally a Amy Klobuchar supporter in the first round of voting, and just so that you understand this, the way that the caucuses went, you come in, you vote. And then if your candidate gets more than 15% of the total people at the precinct, then the candidate is viable, and then you can vote them for them again. If the candidate gets less than 15%, then your candidate is not viable. And so Klobuchar was not viable, so then she decided, well, who she's going to go to now. So as a lot of people have been doing that want a more moderate candidate, she went to Pete Buttigieg. However, after she voted, she found out that the person that Buttigieg was gay. Now, I don't understand how she could have not known that, but I'm going to see if I can play this clip for you. I'm not sure if you'll be able to listen to it. I'll play a little bit of it, but let's see if you can listen, if you can hear this. And again, this is something that you could listen to yourself online.
So are you saying that he has a same-sex partner?
He?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you kidding?
Yeah, he's married to him, yeah.
We need to find out if that's serious.
Well, then I don't want anybody like that in the White House. So can I have my card back?
And he's still there.
I don't know. Yeah. Signed it.
So if you didn't hear that, basically, if you didn't hear that, she's asking for her card back because she found out that Pete was gay. I don't understand how she could not have known that Pete Buttigieg was gay. I mean, it's like all over the place. But anyway, the thing that I really wanted to highlight about this, and I was going to try and find a clip, but I couldn't find it, is what Pete's response was to it, which was incredible. Basically, and he was asked about it on a number of talk shows, but the one that I saw, I think it was on CBS. Basically, he said that, you know, that he, you know, it's unfortunate that she feels that way. But his main point was, you know, if I, no matter who she votes for, you know, when I become president, I'm going to wake up every morning and do my best to be a good president for her, because I want to be a president for everybody. And the other thing that he said was he complimented the poll worker, and who really handled the situation really well, the woman that was talking to her. But anyway, enough about that. I thought that was just crazy. Did you hear about that, Anna?
I definitely heard some about it, and it was just, you know, I think it's interesting. In some ways, I'm not surprised. I mean, I think Mayor Pete, for people who haven't been really closely paying attention, it's not like he leads with his queerness or his gayness.
Not at all.
He leads with his whiteness, his manness, and, you know, I mean,
which upsets some people in the queer community.
He's in, you know, speaking of our topic tonight, I mean, he's got a big race problem. I mean, it's not really resonating with folks of color. And I can imagine that if you have a queer Black man, a queer Latinx or Latina, you know, I think people are going to be a lot more aware of those intersections because, you know, he's got some white and male privilege that can protect him.
Yep. He does. All right. So this happened in England. And this was just wild. I read about this today. So, an English farmer who lived 200 years ago, was apparently more woke about homosexuality than many people are today, according to an entry from his newly unearthed diary. Matthew Tomlinson was a farmer in West Yorkshire in northern England in January 1810. He heard about a naval surgeon who had been executed for sodomy and took to his journal to express why he thought criminalizing homosexuality was wrong. In England and Wales, homosexuality in the 1800s was punishable by death. So anyway, in the diary, Tomlinson reasoned that penalizing people, let alone killing them for something that had been their, quote, nature from childhood, was cruel. So this is right from this guy's diary. Now, I want you to think about this. This is a dude in 1810 writing this. It appears a paradox to me how men, who are men, should possess such a passion, and more particularly so if it is their nature from childhood, as I am informed that it is, if they feel such an inclination and propensity at that certain time of life when youth develops into manhood, it must be considered as natural. Otherwise, as a defect in nature, it seems cruel to punish that defect with death. Now, he did say the word defect here, but then he goes on. It must seem strange indeed that God Almighty should make a being with such a nature and at the same time make a decree that if that being whom he had formed should at any time follow the dictates of that nature, that he should be punished by death. So basically he's saying, why would God make me gay if he thinks it's wrong? Which is, this dude's saying this in 1810. So, but apparently people don't learn.
Well,
so.
I mean, I think we've had a lot of Christian and other missionaries travel throughout the world kind of selling, you know, anti-queer and trans sentiment related to colonization, which I know we're going to talk about.
Yeah. I'm excited to get in. And I'm running a little long here, but I'll do this one little thing and then we'll move on. So, all right. So this is just for fun. So Tim Wright is a scientist from London. And last month, he booked a last-minute flight to Helsinki, Finland. So this guy's in London. He booked a flight to Helsinki, Finland to meet up with a guy that he had just met on Grindr 2 hours earlier. So basically, the guy, he goes on Grindr. There's your typical Grindr fodder. What do you do? What are you into? Exchange of a couple of pics. And then the guy told him that he lives in London and was free to meet tonight or after he gets back from his weekend away in Helsinki, Finland, and jokingly said, unless you want to come to Helsinki. So that's what the guy did. So 20 minutes later, he booked a flight to Helsinki. Now, Helsinki from London is 1,479 driving miles. Now, he flew. It's still 1,131 miles as the crow flies. So this is not the next town over. I mean, this was... So anyway, I don't know what to think about that.
I love it. I love it. Grindr worldwide. It's awesome. Sex positivity all around.
But to think of the lengths that this guy goes to, You know, but I think he viewed it as kind of a more like a an adventure. Mm-hmm. You know, but I personally would be freaked out if some stranger on Grindr flew up to see me, who'd never met me before. But anyway, enough of that. And we will be right back.
It's almost time. WRFG's Americana in the Park celebrates a fifth great year on Sunday, March 1st, with some of Atlanta's finest musicians, including Don McAllister and Claire Pearson, collectively known as the Oramwoods.
Hey, babe, I think I love you, but it's probably too soon to say.
We'll also have the amazing Unknown Lyric and Kim Ware's indie folk and Americana collective, The Good Graces.
His eyes were dark brown, and his heart was made of gold, and his smile, though infrequent, well, it was bright and bold.
And to kick things off, the Celtic Company, including some members of the Buddy O'Reilly Band. We'll also treat you to a unique performance by the Candler Park Water Ballet on land and honor Sharon Wiggins. Sharon produced WRFG's long-running Peach Blossom Festival and is the driving force behind our Sunday morning Americana show, My Own House. Please join us, rain or shine, at the Park Tavern in Piedmont Park on Sunday, March 1st, for WRFG's fifth annual Americana in the Park celebration. The doors open at noon and the music begins at 1. We'll wrap things up around 6. Americana in the Park tickets are $15 in advance through WRFG.org or $20 at the door. Kids under 12 get in free. The Park Tavern is located at 500 10th Street Northeast, Atlanta 30309. Proceeds benefit WRFG 89.3 FM, your independent community radio station for progressive information and hand-picked quality music.
And we are back. For those of you that are just joining us, I'm a little loud here. All right. For those of you that are just joining us, you are listening to Alternative Perspectives on WRFG Atlanta 89.3. I'm your host, Greg Bossen, and we are speaking with Dr. Annalise Singh about her work combating racism and transphobia. And I just wanted to just kind of get the talk moving here. And to tell you, first of all, racism and transphobia, they sound like two different issues to me, but our guest tonight begs to differ. Annalise Singh, and I'm going to brag on you for a little bit. Okay. She's a PhD. She's an award-winning social justice scholar, author, speaker, and community organizer. She speaks on a wide variety of racial justice and LGBTQ plus topics. She's a professor and associate dean of the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in the College of Education at University of Georgia. And how cool it is that you have an Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion.
It's pretty awesome. I love my job.
Yeah, yeah. No, good for you and good for University of Georgia. Trained as a counselor and psychologist, she wrote the Racial Healing Handbook to provide practical activities to challenge privilege, address systematic racism, and engage in collective racial healing. And she also has written a workbook called Queer and Transgender Resilience Workbook. And it focuses on skills for LGBTQ plus healing, empowerment, and social change. Her research, practice, and advocacy explores the resilience and liberation experience of trans people, people of color, survivors of trauma, South Asian immigrants, and social justice and empowerment training. And she has over 100 publications among these areas. So you're a busy woman.
I am.
And a passionate woman.
I am. I mean, I feel like, you know, we have this, you know, this life that we are given to lead, and there's so much fierceness we can bring to our lives. So I think we've got to get so busy at challenging oppression and injustice in every way we can. Mm-hmm. I feel like our freedom-fighting ancestors really fought for us in this moment to have conversations that we never wanted to have before, we never could have before. So,
and you know, actually, why don't we start with, where do you suppose this passion originated from in you? Where did that come from?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Greg. Sure. You know, I'll try to make this short, but I mean, when I get asked quite a bit, like, why I wrote the Racial Healing Handbook or the Queer and Trans Resilience Workbook, and I say about both those things, they just kind of fell out of me. I had to write them. And when I think about my life and how I grew up, it becomes very obvious. Probably these books had a seed and origin before I was ever born. My mom and dad met in New Orleans. They got married in 1968. My mom, a white woman from northern Louisiana, from exactly where Duck Dynasty is filmed. And she then, you got the picture.
I do.
Then she married my dad, who was not from northern Louisiana. He was from India, or the land that's now called India. Actually, he was from the land that's was called Pakistan before the British partition of India. And so he
wonder how her parents felt about that.
Oh, they were not pleased. They pretty much disowned
Or his parents, him. Probably.
You know, they were a little more open. I mean, he was raised in the Sikh religion, and I think there's an openness more of a social justice context. But as they kind of navigated a lot of racism, you can imagine what I and my brother were experiencing growing up in the New Orleans, a very black and white city, where you had these brown, mixed race, kind of white adjacent children. My dad fortunately worked at Xavier University and HBCU. And when we were in the HBCU environment, our interracial family was a little more safe. And when we weren't, I heard my dad called a terrorist. I saw him spit on. You were talking about spit earlier. Yes.
Yeah.
I saw my dad beat up. And I saw my white mom not really know what to do in those moments. And I saw my very Indian brown skinned turbaned dad not quite know what to do as well. They never said, hey, sweetie, or beta, is the kind of Indian term of endearment for a child. He never said beta, like, this is racism. He said beta, they don't know what they do. So as an immigrant to this country, I think it was very confusing for him as well. Now, in the context of that, you know, I also not only was coming out, growing up as a mixed race person, not knowing a lot about racism, but experiencing it.
You don't present as mixed race.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah. It depends on where my skin kind of color gets during the year. It's very interesting.
Oh, really?
Which is why I say white adjacent. Like, I can be very adjacent to white privilege, but in terms of like my true ethnicity, you know, people kind of project onto me. I call myself a racial Rorschach. People project onto me what they need me to be in that moment, right?
I would imagine people would think that you were Latin American.
Yeah, I get Latina, Greek, Jewish, all the things, and sometimes I get white. So you can imagine the things that people talk to me about race were not always the things that white folks would say to black folks or Latina folks would say to white folks or anyone would say to anyone.
But you got to see the difference.
I did. It was called This Bridge Called My Back, which was an interesting experience. And amidst all that, I clued into my sexuality. I came out as queer on the streets of New Orleans in the French Quarter, not the best place to clue into your sexuality.
I'm imagining you yelling it out from the street. You don't mean that, do you? Where were you at that moment?
I was at the corner of St. Anne and Bourbon Street. Actually, I was yelling, and we were screaming.
Oh, you really did?
Oh, we were doing all the things. I mean, I'm so fortunate to have come out of that coming out experience without an addiction, with still being alive.
Totally.
I mean, I had a suicide attempt that I just remembered recently. I had repressed it. So all the things at the intersection of race and sexuality. But you know who taught me to love myself?
Who?
Trans women of color who worked as dancers in the French Quarter bars.
Really?
Who danced with me at the Bourbon Pub and the parade.
And when is this again? In
this
the
is
70s?
Like the, well, 80s? I mean, I'm 40 now.
I'm sorry.
So that's okay. I'll take it. I'm proud to be 50 next year. This was the 80s.
Yeah. All right.
But, you know, where I was experiencing a lot of the racism and the, hey, your dad's a terrorist, that was definitely the 70s. It continued throughout my dad's life. So you can imagine the other thing that was going on is that when I'd visit my family in India, I would learn and see the trans people of India who are very much a part of Indian culture and South Asian culture. So I would see them and I'd be like, ooh, there's something I'm resonating with here, like in terms of their gender identity, sexual orientation, just all the things. So I feel very much that I owe my life to trans people and to queer and trans people of color.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
So that's why I wrote the handbook. Okay. The workbook.
All right. So now I think I wanted to start with the Racial Healing Handbook, which mm-hmm. is the last book you wrote. Is that correct? And you know, I read a little about it, I think it says that, well, this is just, I'm going to read this. The Racial Healing Handbook offers powerful and practical tools to help you explore the history of racism, challenge stereotypes, and manage the stress and remorse that result from living in an unequal world. And I think the first question was, who is this written for?
I wrote it for white people and folks of color to do together, actually. You know, it was very interesting to write because at first I felt like, I can't do this. I can't write a book for everyone. And I was like, this is the book that's coming out of me. It's mm-hmm. for everyone. Because I think for white folks have internalized dominance. That's internalized racism. For folks of color, we tend to have internalized racism in the form of, you know, inferiority. Even if we have racial pride, we're kind of in this world that values whiteness over everything else. So even if we've had the best caregivers and the best education that teaches us to have racial pride, it's still, the world is mirroring something different back to us every day. And so I definitely wrote it for all of us to do together. And, you know, I think, you know, trained as a counselor and a psychologist, you can imagine I work with mostly queer and trans folks of color. And I was just getting really tired and frankly pissed off that every therapy session or every interaction with a student or a colleague who was a queer and trans person of color, we were constantly talking about this imposter phenomenon that would show up, or this feeling that folks weren't good enough to like really embrace all of who they were. And I was like, you know what? We need a self-help book around racism. We have tons of beautiful, intelligent, awesome books about why racism exists.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have really that many resources of what you do about it and how you heal from it. And, you know, it's a set of very proactive practices that once you start putting into your life, you know, when by the time you look back at your life and how you've lived it, I think you can realize that you've actually made a difference in the world when it comes to reducing racism. Are we going to end it in our lifetime? I wish, I dream, I hope, but we've got a few generations to go before we take this racism thing down, I believe.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I consider myself to be racist. I don't know how. And you know the reason why? I mean, I said this before, and Sharon was just shocked when I said it, so that's when
love
she was
Sharon.
Like, but I'm not attracted to black, I'm gay, but I'm not attracted to black guys. I've never been attracted to black guys. Now, to me, that's racist. Now, there's a lot of people that say, well, you don't be hard on yourself, you can't really help who it is that you're attracted to. But to be honest with you, I think it's a little odd that I'm not attracted to black people. And I think it has to do with you know, and maybe the environment that I was raised in, or maybe genetically or something, but anyway, to just cut yourself off from that for that reason is mm-hmm. ridiculous.
Yeah, and for as painful it is for you to say as a white man, and for me to hear as a person of color, and I know for black listeners to hear that is very painful, right? And so, I mean, one of the racial healing strategies is understanding how racism shows up in relationships. And so even for folks of color, we're swimming in the sea of white supremacy. And so, you know, whether we like it or not, we're picking up these images. I mean, I have changed my Instagram so I see people of color artists and images so I can retrain my eyes to what I see as beautiful and what is off. Because if I rely on the media, I am awash in whiteness. And
right.
So I really appreciate what you're saying. And, you know, there's several exercises in the Racial Healing Handbook for you to think about, like, you know.
Yeah, give me an example.
Well, what were your first friendships? You know, what were your first dating relationships? You know, and even beyond that, when was the first time you realized you had a race?
Wow. You know, it's interesting. I had a friend when I was in elementary school, and I was very shy and very alone when I was in elementary school. But I had a friend, Rodney Dodd, and he was black, and he was a friend of mine. And I remember I took him with me to Thanksgiving at my uncle's. But I was very aware of how I think they felt that it was odd. You know, I got the impression that it was weird.
Yeah, they didn't have to say anything. It was just, yeah, you got the feeling, right?
Yeah, because they're, you know, he was a doctor and everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here I come over with this black kid. Plus, I mean, he was poor, you know, and they weren't. You know, so you start to associate all of these negative things. Right. And, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, and, you know, the couple of times I have been attracted to a black guy, it's been a light-skinned black guy. I mean, it's obvious to me that it's an issue.
Right. Well, colorism is an issue for all of us. It's a part of racism. It's all about, you know, skin color, attractiveness, all that. You know, even my Indian family, like, you know, they're like, don't go out into the sun and get too dark. I'm like, where's that coming from? British colonization.
Right.
They left us some chai. Well, we made it chai. We made it better. But wow, they left us huge amounts of internalized racism. And it's not cool. And I think, you know, like what I would encourage you to do is really dig into those messages because they're not even yours.
Right.
You know, but that you're carrying them, you know, you're a carrier, right? And then how does that come out?
Ooh, that's a really good way of putting it. You're a carrier. Yes.
And
even if you're not aware of it, I think you are.
And it's for folks of color too. I mean, for us, we are carriers too, because again, like unless we have practices that are very diligent and strategic about kind of externalizing a lot of what we take on about whiteness and what's of value and what's beautiful or special or, you know, valuable, unless, you know, we're taking on those conceptions too. So,
yeah. So, all right. Well, that gives me some food for thought. So this handbook has literal exercises where you're, I guess, kind of deconstructing it internally for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's laid out. I mean, it's based on my research. It's also based on a lot of my clinical practice and a lot of my personal experience. So there's a wheel of racial healing. There's 10 strategies. At the bottom of the wheel are all these, well, actually at the top of the wheel are all these strategies that are really internal, whether it's like knowing that you have a race, exploring internalized racism, reteaching yourself the history of racism. I mean, Greg, where did racism start? Pop quiz, I am a professor.
Yeah, you know, and I didn't even think about it, but I would have assumed it would have started with slavery.
Okay, and where did slavery start?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think it started in South America somewhere.
So it actually, you know, here's the, I mean, I really attribute Dr. Ibram Kendi, a professor at American University. His book, Stamped from Beginning, really stamped me in terms of knowing the real history of slavery. People have enslaved other people for all of time. It sucks.
Well, yeah, it started in Egypt, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But King Prince Henry of Portugal was the first one to kind of direct both capitalism and racism towards black folks and said, hey, we're going to enslave black folks. Why? Easier to identify because of skin color. And then because they were kind of economically exploiting black bodies, were then able to connect a system of racism that said black people were at the bottom of the heap in terms of intelligence, all these other things. So it literally was a system created 600 years ago that we're trying to like undo to this day.
Wow.
So, I mean, a lot of the individual strategies in the Racial Healing Handbook are about reteaching yourself, grieving. I mean, racism, I don't know, as you were talking about some of your own internalized racism and internalized sense of superiority, right, as a white person,
oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, did some grief come up? You know, we got guilt, we got,
yeah,
we got sadness, we got anger. I mean,
yeah,
all the things. And then the bottom of the racial healing wheel is all about like being in collective, working in relationships, becoming a racial ally, an accomplice, a co-conspirator, and working for collective racial healing.
It sounds like a wonderful handbook. And I'm wondering if I would think it would be best if you had kids in school working on it.
Yes. A lot of people in schools, a lot of people in prisons, a lot of people in churches, mosques, temples have been using it. It's been pretty cool.
All right. Well, we are going to come right back. We're going to take a little break. You are listening to Alternative Perspectives, Atlanta's only queer radio hour, and we'll be back. We're just going to take a quick break, and then we come back. We'll talk more about the trans community and how it relates.
Awesome.
It's almost time. WRFG's Americana in the Park celebrates a fifth grade year on Sunday, March 1st, with some of Atlanta's finest musicians, including Don McAllister and Claire Pearson, collectively known as the Orimwoods.
Hey, babe, I think I love you, but it's probably too soon to say.
We'll also have the amazing Unknown Lyric and Kim Ware's indie folk and Americana collective, The Good Graces.
His eyes were dark brown, and his heart was made of gold, and his smile, though infrequent, well, it was bright and bold.
And to kick things off, the Celtic Company, including some members of the Buddy O'Reilly Band. We'll also treat you to a unique performance by the Candler Park Water Ballet on Land and honor Sharon Wiggins. Sharon produced WRFG's long-running Peach Blossom Festival and is the driving force behind our Sunday morning Americana show, My Own House. Please join us, rain or shine, at the Park Tavern in Piedmont Park on Sunday, March 1st, for WRFG's fifth annual Americana in the Park celebration. The doors open at noon and the music begins at 1. We'll wrap things up around 6. Americana in the Park tickets are $15 in advance through WRFG.org or $20 at the door. Kids under 12 get in free. The Park Tavern is located at 510th Street Northeast, Atlanta 30309. Proceeds benefit WRFG 89.3 FM, your independent community radio station for progressive information and hand-picked quality music.
All right, and we are back. For those of you that are just joining us, you are listening to Alternative Perspectives on WRFG Atlanta 89.3. I'm your host, Greg Bossen, and we are speaking with Dr. Annalise Singh about her work combating racism and transphobia. So in the time that we have left, we've been talking about your book that you wrote, The Racial Healing Handbook, but I'd really like to use this time to kind of bridge the gap and help explain what the connection is between racism and transphobia. So if you could kind of make that a reality for us.
Sure. And I like to say trans prejudice or anti-trans bias only because when I think of phobia, I think about ooh, people are scared of things, but actually people aren't scared. They're taught oppression, right?
I'm glad you did that because I actually had a trouble with that myself because phobia is maybe a piece of it, but not all of it.
Well, that was the defense of the folks who murdered Matthew Shepard, right? Ooh, he scared us.
Right. Oh, yeah, right. Of course.
But I think the link for me is that if we look around the world and we think broadly about gender, if in every single culture and continent, trans, non-binary, gender non-conforming people have existed, right? But did you ever learn about that in your history books?
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. Could you give us an example?
Yeah. I talked before about the Hijra, the trans people of South Asia, who were often, had multiple experiences of gender in their own body, maybe assigned male at birth, but had a more feminine gender presentation and gender identity. And they were often seen as sacred, as holder of blessings and religious rites, and would show, and still to this day, show up at people's homes on the birth occasions of new babies, but also weddings, are very much kind of seen as holder of the blessings. The Mahu, the Polynesian islands of Hawaii and that area, also were the priest and the priestesses of Polynesian culture. And, both in South Asia, in the Polynesian islands, and all around the world where colonization has happened, you see that trans identities are erased and we end up with a binary system of gender. I just have to ask you, when did you first know you were a boy or a girl?
Me?
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. It's funny because I can't remember when, but I assume somebody told me.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. It sucks, you know? I mean, you know, what do we say when a baby is born?
It's a boy or it's a girl.
Exactly.
And then all the things that go with it.
Sure.
Blue versus pink and football versus dolls.
You're right, Greg. I mean, we don't say it's our best guess, you know? Right. Or, you know, that all gender play is good for all people. I mean, all the research says that if we have all gender play, we end up with healthier humans.
But the colonization, could you speak a minute more, a little bit more in detail about it? Maybe use an example of a country that was colonized by... Well, who did that? I guess they all did.
Sure. I mean, you can look at the country we now call the United States. So often, you know, you had the two-spirit people or the people who were trans.
That's in the Indian. They call them two-spirit. America.
It's a more modern term for Native Americans Indigenous people in the land indigenous. We now call the United States. You know, one of the first things they would do is they would take the two-spirit people and they would throw, like, dig ditches, put them in ditches, and, like, put rabid dogs in the ditches and literally destroy trans people, the two-spirit people. Why? Because they were trying to destroy the spiritual fabric of a culture. The first way that you colonize is you destroy culture. One of the most often major parts of culture for many is religion and spirituality. So you had, you know, trans folks who had the fact that they had multiple gender expressions in their same body was seen as, you know, a good thing, a unique thing, you know, not always in every culture. So hopefully that clarifies what that process was like.
But make it, so I guess what you're saying, where does the connection to racism come in?
Well,
because it sounds like maybe in a lot of these societies, they were people... of color.
Yeah. I mean, colonization was a white supremacy project.
Right.
So it's a project of whiteness, you know, and so a puritanicalness of, you know, just European dominance, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, whether we look anywhere we look at colonization, you're going to see a destruction of people of color cultures, a taking over. And so spirituality was a part of that, which meant trans folks were a part of that, which means that racism is at the heart of not only the bad stuff that happened to trans people, but of course, you know, if we look at the highest rates of violence towards trans folks now, it's bad for all trans folks and non-binary folks, but it's especially bad for Black and Latinx trans women.
Yeah. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think that, you know, you've got that intersection of racism and anti-trans bias, right? Anti-trans stigma. So you've got folks that are kicked out of their jobs. They are kicked out of their families. They sometimes, sex work is awesome if it's a choice for you, but if it's survival sex work, it's not. If you have food and housing insecurity, like all those things create potential sites of trauma where you can, the trauma research tells us once you've been traumatized once, the chances of you being traumatized again just increase. It's kind of an insidious thing about trauma. It collects itself because it's harder for you to protect yourself against the world. So I think when you've got racism and trans prejudice intersecting, you just have a really bad recipe.
I'm wondering if you have received pushback with your work over the years from people in the African American community that don't want to be grouped with trans. I know that there's people in the gay community that don't want to be grouped with trans. So I'm wondering if you ever had pushback because you speak about the two.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what I've experienced most, is a pushback from all races around trans. Why? Because the history of trans and non-binary identities has been erased. So we don't have it, right? It seems like a trend or a new thing or a made up thing, and it just isn't. And people don't have that history.
And it's just so, it's so ingrained. It's become so ingrained in our makeup. You know, I mean, whether it be a religion in the Bible, you know, God created man, God created woman, this is what you're supposed to do, you know, or anthropologically speaking, you know, if you want to grow your tribe or whatever, you know, you really kind of need a man and a woman to have sex, and you're messing with it if you're trying to say that you're one or the other when, you know, you have a different body part or something like that. You mess with it. But I just think people are just so, there's something about gender identity that really freaks people out.
Well, because because we've been trained so early, right? And so for cisgender boys, folks who aren't trans, they're trained, what, not to cry, not to show weakness. Why? Because these are feminine qualities. Well, how messed up is that, right?
Right.
And what are little girls taught? You know, don't be too strong, don't stand out. We know when it comes to science and, you know, all the STEM fields, we lose girls and they're not just their interest in science and math, but it's a patriarchal push out of girls from STEM disciplines, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so I think we've got a larger issue with sexism, and I think that's why gender is so visceral for us, right? Because we know how to stand in our boxes, even within the queer and trans community. Hell, we like try to make the boxes as binary as heck, but I think that's the gift of not only trans communities and gender nonconforming communities, but I think of all the history of gender, is that when you look at the fluidity of gender pre-colonization, that wasn't just for them. That's for all of us. I mean, that's for, you know, you and me and like exploring
right.
all of our gender.
Well, it does. If you're able to, like, the fight of the trans community is our fight. It's our fight. It's everybody's fight, because, you know, it frees you from the bondage of whatever box you were placed in and all of the rules that go along with it. You know, you're free to explore who you are. You can be a boy and play with dolls. You can be a girl and, you know, love football or whatever. You're free. You can have emotions. You know, it's really helpful and important. There was something else I was going to say about this, but it's just amazing to me. I guess when I think about it, because it all comes down to the body part is really, you know, well, you know, if with all else fails, you know, somebody's like, well, you have a body part. If you have a penis, then you're a guy. If you have a vagina, you're a girl. So, you know, this is innate. This is something you can't change. It's like, okay, well, what about a hermaphrodite? What if you're born with both parts? And then and what would the person say to that? Well, that's a mistake, really? God made a mistake, you know?
Well, the more current term is intersex, right?
I did it again. Yeah. I'm sorry about that.
Well, we all have our growing edges. And I think what you said is so important, that this is all of our fight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what I like to do is kind of encourage people to think about all of our own gender training. Like, how did we learn to hate our bodies because of our gender? Just think about gay men's community.
Oh,
and
the pressure
the stuff
to be
about bodies.
Yeah, the pressure to, yeah, it's almost like, well, it isn't almost. I think that gay men try to compensate for not being a true man.
It's trauma.
By looking exactly like the manliest man is supposed to look.
The epitome of toxic masculinity, right?
Yeah.
And so same for queer women. And I think, you know, it's just, I think, you know, we end up learning to hate our bodies as queer and trans folks, but also cisgender folks and straight folks learn to hate their bodies too. So for me, what I really try to, the message I'm trying to get out is that trans folks, yes, we need to do better by trans folks. It's ridiculous at this point.
Yeah.
40% of trans people attempt suicide at least once in their lifetime, at least once. You know what the average rates are?
What?
2%.
Wow.
40% versus 2%.
Wow.
We should all be in the streets appalled.
Yeah.
Right? But at the same time, I think when well-meaning cisgender allies start advocating for trans people, that can go sideways if we're not well-educated. So I encourage people to think about what were you taught to not like about your body? What were you taught to not like about your gender? What were the things that you had to give up to be the gender you were taught to be?
Right.
And then if our liberation is connected, cisgender and trans people, the shared struggle is to unlearn those messages and to find ways to not just like self-love and not just body positivity, but to actually work towards a shared gender freedom. I mean,
yeah.
That's what I think is the fight for all of us. It's the fight for all of our lives, literally.
Yeah, gender freedom. I love it. All right, so we've got just a couple of more minutes here, and I did want to get to the Queer and Transgender Resilience Workbook.
Mm-hmm.
This this is a workbook that I guess you wrote in 2017. Mm-hmm. And it teaches you how to challenge, internalize negative messages, handle stress, and build a community of support and embrace your true self. Is this book for trans people or is it for everyone?
It's for queer and trans folks.
Queer and trans folks. And it's called the Queer and Transgender Resilience Workbook. And you talk about how resilience is a key ingredient for psychological health and wellness. So I wanted to give you just a minute to talk about what resilience means and how it is so important to the work that you're doing.
Sure. Queer and trans resilience is what I've been studying for the last couple of decades. And if you think about resilience, it's like what helps you get out of bed. Like you're feeling tired, you know, it's that stuff that it lets you kind of move on with your day. But for queer and trans folks, we've got anti-queer and trans messages from society, right? So that's typically sitting on top of our own natural innate resilience, right? So what I'm very passionate about is realizing that we do develop resilience to navigate oppression, right? You know how to navigate anti-queer messages, right? There's some you may not know how to navigate.
No, I have theory. Yeah, okay. I have ways of doing it. Right. Yeah.
But maybe a couple of decades ago, your resilience muscle wasn't as strong. So right. This workbook is really about looking at community, looking at messages you learned about yourself, what you internalized about yourself. I mean, for me, I like to think that I don't have any internalized, like, you know, anti-trans or queer stuff, but it lives in me too. And it's probably why I didn't have children. And that's a hard thing to say, right? I think working through the workbook is about getting freedom. Resilience is on the way to liberation. And mm-hmm. So that's why I think it's so important for our community. It's about freeing ourselves from all the BS we've been taught and really embracing this life so we can live it as fully as we can.
Yeah, no, well, that sounds wonderful. So just a couple of a little things, I did want to bring out a couple of programs that you're running. One is the Georgia Safe Schools Coalition. And what is that about?
So I co-founded the Georgia Safe Schools Coalition back in 2009. I don't know if you remember Jaheim Herrera. He was an 11-year-old child of color who hung themselves in their mom's closet with a belt. They were bullied at the intersection of racism, gender, and probably sexual orientation. We don't mm-hmm. know. And I think I heard that story, and I heard lots of stories that were going on in Athens. And I was like, we've got to get in schools because there's so many teachers, counselors, principals wanting to do the right things in Georgia, but they often feel scared. And so we come in as consultants, we work with them to do training. We've trained over 1,500 educators in Georgia and have worked on a lot of policy change.
Wow. All right. Well, good for you. Now, I'm going to have to go ahead and stop for now, but thank you so much, Dr. Singh, for coming. And thank you for educating me and putting up with my inability to have the right words. It's not hermaphrodite. We're not in the 1500s, I guess.
You know what? We're all getting to learn.
I appreciate
that. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. And I'd love to have you back soon because I'd like to talk to you at some point about a theory that I have that really homophobia comes down to sexism in a way.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so that's it. Up next, we have What the Folk. And thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Oh, by the way, we have the head of the Republican log cabin Republicans on next week. So be ready for that.